At Sephora, we know how you love to use makeup, skincare, hair care, and fragrances that work for you, but also how important it is to be in the know about the ingredients that are in them, which is why we created Clean at Sephora. Curated products from brands like Merit, Amika, Summer Fridays, and Fleur that have everything you want, minus certain ingredients you might not. Clean at Sephora is only at Sephora. Shop now at Sephora.com.
Welcome to Scientific American Science Talk, posted on June 25th, 2019. I'm Steve Mirsky. On this episode,
we can define it, you know, in relatively basic scientific terms. That is a combination of collagen, which is the flexible part, and hydroxyapatite, which is the hard mineral part. And you put those together and you get something that's both strong and flexible. But that's not really satisfying. You know, that doesn't really, you know, get at, I think, the meaning and the poetry and the expression of bone.
That's Brian Switek. He describes himself as a fossil fanatic and as a, quote, collection of 206 some odd bones and associated soft tissues, end quote. He writes the Scientific American paleontology blog Laylaps. That's the mythological dog who always caught what he was chasing. And he's the author of the new book, Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone. He recently visited Scientific American, where we talked about the book.
I had an experience a few years ago that was really eye-opening. I had to have some dental work done. And instead of the regular x-ray, I had that new thing where they swivel around the whole front of your face. And then the dentist showed me the x-ray, the panoramic x-ray. And she pointed out to me how, as a teeth grinder, I had actually widened out my jawbone, and you could see the new bone that I had created by my actions. But that's happening all the time in our total skeletons.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's this constant process where new bone is being created, new bone is being eaten up. Like one of the examples, just to pick an extreme that sort of, you know, proves the rule is osteoporosis, which, you know, affects a lot of people in older age, can affect people at other times of life. But this is this imbalance where not enough new bone is forming, or the bone is being resorbed too quickly, or both at the same time. But the whole reason it happens is because we have this constant turnover in our skeletons. And it should be pretty obvious to see. I mean, we know, you know, we're not born, you know, as adults. That would be awful and horrifying. We're born small and our bones aren't fused yet. In fact, that we have more individual pieces of bone connected by cartilage that all fuse together into our, you know, 206, you know, more or less skeletons, and those continue to change. So even though we experience it, it's like geologic time. It's at such a rate that we don't really see it, and we need to like stop and think about it, or there needs to be something like a pathology or something that's changed. And this is the same stuff. It's really kind of wonderful, I think, that the same process that maintains our skeletons, that grows our skeletons, also allows them to heal from things like fractures. And I mean, unfortunately, it can also lead to things going awry and lead to bone growing places you don't want it, or changing the shape of your bones. But it's all very basic. It's part of the same outcome of our skeletons as living tissue.
Sharks have done great.
Yes.
With cartilage, mm-hmm. just cartilage. So what was the advent of bone able to do for evolution?
I mean, quite a bit. I mean, really, when you think about creatures, not just with skeletons, because as you just pointed out, you know, sharks have skeletons, but they're made of cartilage. And they've, you know, survived, you know, 400 million years is a pretty fine record. Bone as a tissue, a skeleton made of bone and not just of cartilage or some other material. You know, everything from, you know, the biggest dinosaurs that we can think of, these things that are, you know, over 110 feet long and 45 some odd tons, down to these little, you know, amphibians. I think the smallest frog in the world is like the size of a fly. Like it can sit like, you know, on a penny with plenty of room to spare. And it's all a skeleton. It's still made of bone. And bone as a versatile sort of construction material, if you want to use that sort of analogy, it really opens up a vast possibility of different body shapes, of different kinds of movements. If you think of all the vertebrates, you know, whether, you know, bats that fly, you know, dolphins that swim, you know, us walking upright, all that stuff comes from bone. But what bone initially did was it was armor. It was protection. It really goes back to this pre-bone tissue called aspidin that it took me a little while to wrap my head around it, because when I read about it for the first time, and this is something that appeared over 400 million years ago, and these little basically proto-fish, early fish that looked something like Roombas with the tail sticking out the back end. You know, so this kind of like round thing. They didn't have jaws yet, just this hole at the front and this tail at the back.
So that makes me think of a horseshoe crab.
Something that looks similar like that, but a vertebrate. And they didn't have an endoskeleton quite like we do. They had a support structure inside, but it wasn't made of bone tissue yet. And they had this outer covering of this material called aspidin that, when I read about it, it said it's acellular bone tissue. And I was like, well, what does that mean? Because our bones are cellular. They have their bone cells. We just talked about that a moment ago, like what they're always doing. So how does that work? And it was basically bone as teeth, because we have acellular tissue, like the enamel of our teeth. It doesn't, you know, once we've got it, once we grow it and we have it as adults, it doesn't change any further. We can wear it down, but it doesn't grow or maintain itself. So basically the first bone was much more like a tooth, and it was part of this outer armor back when invertebrates, all these weird arthropods, you know, they're left over from, you know, the Cambrian explosion, were still the dominant forms of, you know, life on Earth and in the oceans. And then once bone appeared, once bone, you know, originated as this outer protective covering, then other parts of the skeleton started to become mineralized. And we see some of this today. Like, there's some, you can be injured and grow bone in part of your body where it's not normally supposed to be. People have even grown bone in their salivary glands, of all places. So
that's not good.
No. I'm trying to imagine how that would feel. And just even that now is kind of making me, like, you know, tongue around in my mouth a little bit, like from the sympathy pain at the thought. But, you know, once you had this outer coating, you know, the way that some paleontologists describe this as that we have a sunken endoskeleton. So the beginnings of our skeletons were on the outside, and then the internal skeleton that already existed started to become mineralized. And that provided some advantage in the biomechanics of moving around, like muscle attachments, being able to maybe get a little stronger push and pull, because muscles and our skeletons are constantly interacting with each other. So it's one of these things where it's like you have this, you know, accidental mutation, just something comes up, it turns out to be advantageous. And then the way the physiology of it worked allowed, you know, the endoskeleton to eventually form, you know, to lose that outer shell and gain some more flexibility and that internal support. But, you know, and that's, you know, the origins of it. But really what I love about bone and what I find so fascinating about it is, for example, we're here in New York City. I went to the American Museum of Natural History as a kid and fascinated by the dinosaur skeletons. I mean, I go back, you know, during this visit to do much the same thing I did as when I was five. But I can look at the skeleton of their Apatosaurus or any dinosaur, any skeleton really there, and say, okay, this is the corresponding part in my skeleton. It's the same chassis, just a slightly different expression. And to look at, you know, just the variety that's been able to exist, you know, with invertebrates, you know, we all learn the five classes, I guess, in elementary school that, you know, got fish and amphibians and reptiles and mammals and birds. But we've all got more or less the same parts, whether it's a fish or a tyrannosaur or a frog or whatever it is, that we're able to see, you know, that we share this common ancestry that's built on bone.
You say in the book, Neil Shubin, of course, his book, The Inner Fish, he reminded us that we have this remnants of fish in us. Mm-hmm. But you say, actually, we are fish. And I really like that. I mean, basically, we're all just variations on fish. I mean, everything, us, elephants, marmosets, mm-hmm. you know, it's just it's fish that have figured out different ways to live.
Oh, absolutely. And that came partially from one of Shubin's colleagues, Ted Deschler, at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. I went to go see Tiktaalik while that skeleton was still there before it was sent back to Canada.
Explain what Tiktaalik is.
So Tiktaalik is one of the keystone fossils in understanding that one of our favorite evolutionary transitions from water to land. And it was something that, you know, for a long time, this is also like the culture of science, like some of these things that we we set upon as, you know, a glorious example of evolutionary change. It kind of has its own momentum to it. The idea used to be that there are these lungfish and they're in these drying ponds and they kind of flop from one to another, and those that were able to flop a little bit better between them, you know, eventually were able to evolve legs and kind of drag themselves until they're able to move around on their own. It turns out that that's not true. The beginnings of our limbs really started in the water. Not only the construction of having one upper arm bone and then two lower arm bones and a whole bunch of fiddly bits below that that became digits, that those evolved in an aquatic environment. It wasn't, and then it allowed for some movement on land, but the classic story wasn't true. And Tiktaalik was, part of that. There's actually, at least half a dozen, if not more, of these, fishapod type creatures that are sort of in between the water and the land, where they're just like they're really lived at the water's edge, maybe could take little forays out and come back. But Tiktaalik is one of these fossils. It kind of looks like a slightly fishier version of like an alligator. And some of them got to alligator size and it was living in a similar way. We think it was something like an ambush predator. But because it had a really glorious fossil and, came from an interesting place and, Neil's a great storyteller, it became one of these keystone fossils. There are other ones, things like Pandorichthys and Acanthostega and all these other famous ones. But Tiktaalik has kind of become the poster child, which even Ted, called it. But I went to go see this fossil and, for me, it was like meeting a celebrity, because it's, cover of Nature, right. that's in our geeky circle, that's, as good as you can get. But I was talking to Ted about this and saying like, well, how critical are fossils like Tiktaalik to understanding this transition? And this would be, his opportunity to really toot his own horn because, he worked with Shubin, up in Ellesmere, digging out these fossils in the extreme cold. And, he could have said, this is like the really key iconic thing. He's like, well, really the vertebrate body plan as we know it was set even before that for the past about 400 million years or so. It says variations on a theme. And, part of this, you mentioned that we are fish. It's like, I wanted to include that in there because this gets into the systematics and the philosophy of how we name and organize things. It's a question that I often run into from the dinosaur side, saying like, wait, if birds are dinosaurs and dinosaurs are reptiles and aren't birds reptiles, it's like, yeah, that follows. It's true. And the old classification scheme, the way that we broke things down, it was – basically starting from the modern and going backwards. And you see all these divisions, but as you get into the fossil record, those divisions disappear and one group slides into another group. So really, we can look at fish today, modern fish, as a distinct group, this sort of top-down view. But if we take the evolutionary view and like look for connections rather than differences, every vertebrate that we see, including us, we are fish. And it's if you know what to look for, if you know the sort of keys, you can identify, all the parts that we have in our body were there in fish first.
You talk in the book about these little modifications that have a big effect on how we can move. And one example you give is if you ask your dog to give you five, you have to do it upright where you're your arm is perpendicular to the ground, and the dog can respond that way. But the dog can't do it sideways. A cat can do it sideways, though.
Yes.
Because they have different wrist structures.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, this is something, one of the advantages of living with pets. So this was inspired by just interacting on a daily basis with, my own cat, Margarita, who, in the morning, if I don't remember to close the door all the way, she'll come in and she'll boot me on the face. And it's that sideways kind of turn. And it's the same thing when I see her play with a ball or a mouse or something like that. She's able to do that. And, because that's the way cats evolved to be predators, that they use their paws and their claws to grab things and pull it close.
I should just say I got slapped in the face by a cat at 6 o'clock this morning.
Yeah. We're all familiar with this. If it's good, like readers would get this immediately. They evolved, with the exception of the cheetah, which is a little bit different, they largely evolved as ambush predators, that they're jumping under things and grabbing it and then biting it. Dogs, are descended from wolves, and those are pursuit predators. So the motion of their limbs is very much about running and then getting close enough to use their jaws, on whatever it is that they're pursuing. So that change the motion of their limb. So like an out-and-out race, like I said, with the exception of something like a cheetah, which is adapted a little bit differently, you know, a dog's a better endurance runner, and that's reflected in the range of motion that they have. So my German Shepherd Jet, like when I, you know, want to tell him he's a good boy and put my hand out to get five, I, you know, put my palm out down and relatively flat. If I made him, you know, when basically when we shake with the dog, we're doing it on their terms and their range of motion. They can't turn those paw pads sideways without, you know, laying over and then turning their whole arm. And I threw dinosaurs in there as well, because, you know, when we all do the, you know, impression of a T-Rex or a Velociraptor, you know, it's usually with the palms facing down and the wrists, you know, the bunny hands kind of thing, because that's how they are in Jurassic Park, right? But unfortunately, you may be shocked to find this out. Jurassic Park is not necessarily entirely scientifically accurate. Dinosaur wrists, and I'm the theropod ones, the things like Velociraptor and T-Rex, it's like a chicken wing, that they don't have that turning flexibility that we do. So what we usually say is that they're clappers, not slappers, that they had to hold their palms facing each other rather than their palms facing down. If they wanted to get that that sort of angle on it, they'd have to like move their entire arm to then move the wrist into such a way that it didn't have the same flexibility that we do. But, you know, because we're us and we're, you know, we are very manipulative primates in the way that and that's been very key to our own evolution. It's easy to look at other animals and say like, oh yeah, they can move just like we do. But like that's actually not true at all. There's distinct limits to the range of motion that's possible. And we're kind of weird in what we're capable of. A lot of that goes back to, you know, our ancestors' life in the trees, and being able to move around in this sort of three-dimensional, you know, more so than in other environments, but like this environment has a little bit more complexity in it. And I shoulder blades were something that really struck me when I looked at the human skeleton, because they're not really attached very well to the rest of it. You would think that, you know, as much as we use our arms and our hands, like even getting here, you know, opening doors, swiping my Metro card, all this stuff, you know, this morning, that we'd have a really solid attachment of our arms and our hands, the rest of our bodies, something like, you know, how our thigh bone, our femur goes into our hip socket. That's a pretty solid looking socket. But if you follow the bones of your hand and your arm and you go all the way up to the top of your humerus, there's a pocket on your shoulder blade that receives that end of the humerus, and then your collarbone goes from the top of your chest and goes over to attach to the shoulder blade as well. But your shoulder blade, it's not glued onto the bone. It's not attached to anything. It just slides back and forth, and your arm is attached to that. And the only like strong connection is basically between your collarbone and the top of your rib cage, which, you know, everything else is being held in there by soft tissues, and it gives us our range of motion, but also, you know, is why we have problems dislocating our shoulders. And, you know, there's flexibility, but there's also a cost to it.
And that's why a human being can throw a baseball 100 miles an hour, and he can throw it 100 miles an hour overhand or three quarters, or, you know, probably lose some velocity, but sidearm. And a chimp, which is way stronger than an adult human being, can only kind of push an object that it's trying to toss, or it could toss it underhand.
Yeah, I think chimps have a fair amount of mobility because they still are pretty good in the trees. But the primates that I use an example were olive baboons, because they spend a lot more time on the ground. They're a lot more quadrupedal. Their shoulder blades are arranged in a way that's a lot more like a dog or a cat, sort of to the sides. And they can only do underhand. And I remember picking this up when I was taking a primatology course in college, and the professor was talking about how olive baboons like will sometimes, you know, get annoyed with tourists and throw rocks at them, but they have to throw underhand. So if things were different, and this sort of struck me, because for a while, and this wasn't in the book, but I always found it kind of, you know, an interesting idea. Olive baboons were taken as a great example of early humans because they lived out in the grasslands. So back when the sort of like man the hunter hypothesis was big, it wasn't chimpanzees that were taken as, you know, our best example of what our early relatives were like. It was olive baboons because of where they lived and their lifestyle. And just thinking about that, and like if we had evolved more directly from that kind of ancestor, that we might not have baseball. It might be, you know, the World Series might be softball because we can only do underhand.
Right. Underhand, slow pitch softball. Yeah. You start the book with this incredible story about this guy at the Smithsonian. Yeah. Why don't you just give us a little tease about this?
Oh, experience? That's Grover Krantz, right? Yeah. So it was before I really knew I was going to write Skeleton Keys. And I was in town in D.C. to see – I forget why I was there. But I was with a friend of mine, Miriam Goldstein, who's another science communicator. I used to work for Deep Sea News. And we wanted to go tour around and look at some bone stuff. And I was like, oh, it's really cool because at the time there was an exhibit called Written in Bone about I believe it was archaeology and historical osteology in that part of the country, in the Chesapeake Bay area. And a lot of it focused on pathology and different things like that. But there was a skeleton that stood out from all the rest. There was a much more recent skeleton at the very end of exhibit. It was a skeleton of anthropologist Grover Krantz. And I had run into him, weirdly enough, I wish I could have said that I was familiar with the body of his academic work beforehand. I mostly knew him because he appeared sometimes on Bigfoot documentaries because he was a fan of the idea that Sasquatch was an actual creature. But I was really taken by the story because for the reconstruction that they did, much like you would reconstruct a dinosaur or anything else, the curators there or the preparators there took a photograph of him and one of his wolfhounds. And, I guess he kept several wolfhounds that he loved very much. And as they passed away, he skeletonized them and he saved those. And he wanted to, keep teaching through his osteology, after he passed away. And, part of the stipulation was to take his dogs as well as him. And it seemed for a while he was probably going to just be in a cabinet, which is
before the bones. The whole body went to the
body farm. Yes, to be defleshed, and
so that's for teaching forensics.
That's right. Yeah, and seeing how bodies break down, and sort of things like if you find this kind of beetle on a body, you can tell like how long it's been. A lot of, like the stuff that you end up seeing on Bones or CSI and things like that comes from the actual research done at these places. But, after Krantz passed away, it seemed like he might be in a drawer for a little while. But they had, because of this exhibit, this opportunity to kind of make his wish come true. So they took this photo of one of his wolfhounds jumping up at him. They had to alter a little bit because I think when they did the initial plan, it looked like the dog was going to like rip his throat out, even though there were skeletons. So they made it a little friendlier. But they took this photograph and reconstructed him and his dog as much as they possibly could or was accurate. And I really thought it was fascinating to, not only, see this person who was, significant to the field of anthropology, but this sort of study in the vertebrate form, because most of the bones that, you'd see in his dog were also present in Krantz. They're just a little bit different. Like there's really – his dog had a bone that he didn't have, and that's the baculum. Male dogs have a penis bone. A lot of I should throw in there too, because this bone is often neglected, that many female mammals, especially rodents, have their equivalent genital bone called an osculatoris or a balbellum that we don't really know what it does and is kind of understudied. And that's a whole other issue with, sort of the sexism sometimes that exists in science and what we study. But in this particular case, it was really neat to have this compare and contrast all laid out there. And even though that we're separated from, canids by over 66 million years of evolution, that it's all still there, that you can map bone for bone what's there between them.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. Some people might find that ghoulish, but I mean, I don't. I assume you don't. I think it's great. I mean, this guy was so devoted to his profession and to teaching that he really wanted. I mean, a lot of people donate their bodies to science either as cadavers for medical school or the body farm or, there are plenty of ways to do it. But this guy, I just think it's marvelous that he's put me on exhibit, use my bones,
Yeah, so. I know personally that I would love it. But that gets into, a little bit of what I talk about later in the book, in the sort of culture of science, that there are people who that's a terrifying thought because there is a history of racism and violence that has been committed against many groups of people, particularly non-white people, using their – basically stealing their bones, stealing their bodies, and then using those bones to say, well, these people aren't as intelligent or they, are culturally backwards or, now we have scientific proof that, this order that we're trying to maintain, this power that we're trying to maintain culturally is the way that it really should be. And there's some stories, particularly from, Native Americans who are archaeologists and anthropologists who they know all too well when they look at skulls and skeletons in collections, what that's meant to them in their culture. So someone like me, you know, who, you know, is coming from a relative place of privilege, it sounds great. You know, I love bones and osteology. To me, it'd be an honor to be in a museum or put on display. I can, you know, even see it now being reconstructed at, like, you know, a facsimile of my desk with, you know, the skeleton of Jet maybe next to me, you know, waiting for a walk. But to other people, it's not even so much ghoulish, but it's a reminder of the way science has sometimes abused its power. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, anthropology in the United States started out as a racial and racist science. And by that, I mean that the primary question that anthropologists in the 18th and 19th centuries were concerned with were basically defining and delineating and ranking races of people. And a lot of, you know, the racism and, you know, basically social consequences that came from those things we're still dealing with today. Like, it really took me aback that, you know, I had, you know, we all have that in-law or we all have that relative or whoever it is that, you know, has a certain political view that they want to share. And hearing some things that they were saying about, you know, people of color or otherwise are exactly the same things that some of these anthropologists were saying in the 1800s. And, you know, even though we might like to think that we're well beyond those things, that the science has moved beyond those things, that we're being more responsible now, that we're really starting to talk about consent a lot more in terms of, like, how these bodies are collected and reposited and studied and all these things. A lot of the effects that came from the origins of the science, they're still there. And I think that, you know, anthropology and archaeology still has a responsibility to confront these things and to not sweep it under the rug. There was a quote that kind of incensed me when I read it. There was a technical volume on 20th century anthropology and archaeology. And in one of the quotes, the researcher included this in the book as well, was saying, well, you know, chemistry got its start through alchemy and astronomy, you know, got its start through astrology and things like that. And just because we used to do things wrong doesn't mean that we're going to throw out the modern science. It's like I get the point, but at the same time, anthropology started in such a way that it caused incredible harm and suffering to a lot of people, and we're still stuck with that. So, you know, it's easy to walk away and say, okay, we're doing better now, we're a bit different. But the effects of how things started still remain. And there's still, you know, people, you know, if we think of bone skeletons as people and not just as scientific objects, we don't know how they were collected, where they came from, you know, what happened to them, how they were traded around, you know, in museum collections. And it causes people distress to this day. And we still have to confront this. And I think there are some anthropologists and archaeologists who are doing a good job of this. And that, for example, I think it was at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, and this is something else I mentioned in the book, that there was a bunch of human remains that nobody knew who they were, where they came from. They were unidentified. They didn't seem to be Native American, but it's just human remains that weren't being used. And a lot of these skeletons that aren't labeled or have no data, they don't get used because we don't have that critical information that actually makes them useful to science or tell us something that we want to know. So the archaeologists, I believe, who, you know, oversaw these remains, they basically called in this interfaith group and said, okay, like, we're not sure what to do with these. We don't need them in our collection anymore. We'd like to give them a respectful end. How do we best do that? And they came up with a solution that satisfied everybody. And I think even just having those conversations now about, you know, changing this old view of, well, the dead don't have rights. Like, once you're dead, you're dead. And, you know, you can become an object or you're in the ground or whatever it is. You know, I'm glad that we're moving beyond that. And I kind of wanted to give a loudspeaker to those efforts.
Yeah, good. Yeah, you talk in the book about typology and how the kinds of early anthropologists were kind of trying to confirm typologies. And it's ironic because it's after or concurrent with Darwin. And Darwin's whole deal was typology is completely wrong. There's such variation rather than looking for a particular type that – I mean, that's why it's typology, a particular type that defines the species. I mean, you talk in the book about how, yeah, the basic human body plan is 206 bones, but – you know, more or less. Yeah, a lot of people have extras or they're missing one or two.
That's right. And it's a matter of how we look at things, whether we're looking for similarities or we're looking at differences. This is something that, you know, goes back to my first book. So this has been on my mind for a while. So in my first book, Written in Stone, I wrote a whole chapter about human evolution and basically our transition from being more ape-like to, you know, the people we are now. But the amount of change that we went through is so minor compared to some of these other transitions in the book, like going from something that's more or less a fish to an amphibian on land, or going from, you know, a feathered dinosaur to a bird, or you know, going from this little deer-like thing running around on the ground to a whale. Like, these are pretty dramatic transformations, where if you look at the skeletons of, you know, between us and, you know, Homo erectus, or, you know, Lucy, or, you know, going back to Ardipithecus or whatever it is, like basically wherever you join that root, it's so small, but we've made them huge because we're trying to define ourselves as separate. And this is the same sort of issue whether we're talking about race or whether it's, you know, the number of bones in the skeleton or whatever it is, that, you know, if we're looking for differences, yeah, you can find those, but you're always going to have these confounding factors, these variables and these things that don't fit. That basically if you set out, say, these are the boxes that I have and everything needs to go in a box, you're going to end up making mistakes and you're not going to see the bigger picture. So a lot of this is the way that we look at biological variation. The fact that, as you mentioned, you know, with Darwin, this is the raw stuff that natural selection works on, that life wouldn't exist as we know it. Evolution wouldn't happen if we didn't have variation and this sort of connectivity between different, you know, expressions of body forms and bone counts and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, I know that there's a sort of, you know, push at times to say, oh, well, we didn't know as much then, it was different. But there is a sort of social justice aspect to this, and that, you know, this wasn't, you know, something that was biologically prevalent that then, you know, we said, well, you know, that's what nature is. We're just following where the evidence leads. These are preconceived notions that then biology was shoved into, and it's taken a long time to dismantle those things, and we're still doing that.
Yeah, it's not just raw data collection. You quote Darwin in the book talking about people who think, well, all you should do is collect and observe and characterize. And he says that you get nothing with that. Mm-hmm. You must have some kind of a theory that you're going to either confirm or overthrow with whatever you collect. And that will lead you toward what's really going on.
Absolutely. And I mentioned that in the case of Samuel Morton, who was in the news again relatively recently. So to recap this relatively briefly, Morton was a Philadelphia polymath and naturalist and anatomist in the mid-1800s. And, you know, he was very concerned with, like, defining the five races of people. And he was going to do this through skull measurements. And, you know, he started collecting what human skulls he could. And people started sending him skulls. And, you know, we don't always know where these skulls came from or even if the data that came with them were correct. So he'd get something that was labeled as, you know, Egyptian or Ethiopian or belonging to a particular Native American tribe. And it's like he just went with whatever the label was that was sent. We don't know if any of this is actually accurate. But in any case, he amassed this huge collection of skulls, and he was going to do or he carried out this experiment where first he used, I think, mustard seed to, like, pack it into the cranium of these skulls and, you know, come up with the endocranial measurement. So basically how big the brain was, since there's a relatively close fit between brain and skull. So if you have the skull, you can get an estimate of the brain size. And he didn't – he threw out the mustard seed results because he found you could basically pack more in depending on, you know – and he couldn't control for the variables and seed size and stuff like that. So he basically used BB pellets, lead shot as a replacement, because even though it didn't fill the volume as completely, it came up with much more accurate and repeatable measurements. So, you know, and he, you know, was kind of has been held up sometimes by anthropologists as sort of the objectivist of his age. He didn't theorize. There was, you know, a preface to his book talking about, you know, how important it was by a famous phrenologist. But really, it was basically in his books is here's the data and here's how I'm organizing this. And I'm just going to let people do with it what they will. And what people did with it was justify slavery and that, you know, white people should be at the, you know, top of social power and all this stuff. And Morton didn't, like, say a word about this because he more or less agreed with it in his private letters. But, you know, as, you know, the Civil War played out, as, you know, evolution by natural selection became accepted and variability became, you know, much more interesting and prevalent to biologists. You know, basically all this work that Morton did eventually fade into the background until along comes one of my writing heroes, Stephen Jay Gould, in the late 20th century. And he looks at Morton's results. He's like, yeah, when you look at the difference between the mustard seed results and the lead shot results, Morton seemed to be actively, perhaps subconsciously, suppressing the endocranial volume of people of color. That basically, when you look at the difference between those initial results that he didn't think were super accurate and the ones they felt were more accurate, the differences between them seemed to show some bias in there. And this caused, you know, a big to-do in recent years because the people who keep the Morton collection currently went back and said, well, Morton's measurements were accurate. But they only looked at the lead shot results. They didn't actually address the point that was being made, that it's the difference between them that shows Morton's bias. And what I really appreciate is that a lot of historians have since come out and said, this is garbage in, garbage out. That, you know, it doesn't really matter how accurately Morton was making his measurements. The fact was that he had a preconceived notion about biology that we know was incorrect. He was taking in skulls from wherever that might not have belonged to the categories he was putting them in to start with. And then taking measurements and just kind of putting those out there without interpretation or theory or anything else. And it's an interesting episode in the history of science, but, you know, either tearing Morton down or defending him on the basis of how he took his measurements doesn't really make any sense because it doesn't really matter what the lead shot results were, or the mustard seed results, or anything like that. It was that he was working from a typology that we know is incorrect and was carrying out science in a way that's not repeatable or understandable. But I want to use that as an example, I guess, of how these debates still, you know, affect us and how sometimes we can lose sight of what's actually important here. Like we can quibble about, you know, whether this measurement is accurate or not, but it's like, but what framework are we actually putting this into?
Right. I mean, within his framework, wouldn't elephants be a lot smarter than us?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, you know, blue whale would be the smartest creature right. on the planet.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And maybe it is.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But we currently don't have the ability to know that.
We'll see if that'll be the Douglas Adams effect. If exactly. all the whales just, you know, go into space one day, we'll know.
Exactly. Or maybe they've just gotten way past everything we do. Hey, man, I'm just hanging out in the ocean. I'm living the dream. Well,
as someone who suffers from depression and anxiety, I'd like to know the whale's secret if that's the case.
You in the past have really concentrated on mostly dinosaurs and other paleontological stuff. Why did you decide to turn your attention to the skeleton, especially of human beings? Because you do range a lot in the mm-hmm. book, but basically the through line is we're looking at our own skeleton here.
That's right. Yeah, I think the genesis for this came from I was doing some field work out at a ghost ranch in New Mexico. And there's a site out there called the Hayden Quarry that's about 220 million years old or so. And the paleontologists who study it, most of them are Berkeley alums and they all know each other and they've been doing this for a number of years. And you know, I was lucky enough to go out and do some field work at the site. So, you know, thinking about bones all day, you know, scratching away, you know, looking for them, looking for, you know, early dinosaurs and their neighbors. But at night, you know, we hang out in camp and somebody was talking about how for a PhD defense of another researcher who I think was not present at that time, but he spent his whole defense, oral defense, on the question of just what is bone? And we can define it, you know, in relatively basic scientific terms. That is a combination of collagen, which is the flexible part, and hydroxyapatite, which is the hard mineral part. And you put those together and you get something that's both strong and flexible. But that's not really satisfying. You know, that doesn't really, you know, get at, I think, the meaning and the poetry and the expression of bone. You know, if you, you know, walk up to, you know, the T-Rex skeleton here at the American Museum of Natural History and say, yeah, that's a pile of hydroxyapatite and collagen. That's not really, you know, it doesn't get at, you know, what the way that I feel or think many people feel about bone. So it really, I started with that thread of, well, what is it and how did it form, where it appear, how it open up. And this led to a lot of, like, I didn't know that moments. Like, I didn't know that, for example, the layout of our skeleton and the formation of bone as a tissue were two separate events. They didn't go together. And I wanted to you know, basically as I started pulling at these threads, talk about bone as something living. This is really how we started off even this podcast, talking about bone as a living, malleable, changing tissue. And so often when we see it in pop culture, with some exceptions, you know, one counterexample would be like the Day of the Dead celebrations in Mexico. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, you know, it's like, you know, the Jolly Roger flag on a pirate ship, you know, poison labels like "Don't Drink This," death metal album covers, because we only really see bones with the exception of things like CT scans or x-rays or things like that, like basically after death, that like they stand for these symbols of permanent death when everything has been stripped away. And I wanted to take that sort of paleontological approach, that if I wrote about my own skeleton or about the human skeleton in the same way that I've written about dinosaurs in the past, how would I do that? And, you know, even in the book previous to this, My Beloved Brontosaurus, like, yeah, I talked about, you know, dinosaurs and their biology and their skeletons, but also the pop culture aspect of it and what they mean to us and why. So it was really, you know, instead of looking backward so much, even though I talk about fossils and paleo quite a bit in Skeleton Keys, it was taking the same approach that I would use, you know, to a stegosaurus skeleton and just turning it to people. Like, not only, you know, how did it form and what does it mean, how did it move, but what's the culture surrounding it and how have we interpreted this and how has that changed through time? And, you know, the through line through all my writing, even though I focus on fossils and paleontology, is, most of it is how does science work? And that, what are the questions we ask? How does that affect the answers that we feel that we get? How does that change over time? And that the change in the self-correcting nature of this is a good thing. It's, you called out that Darwin quote earlier, that, you know, it's something that I think is very easy to forget, even for us who are, you know, relatively scientifically minded. Sometimes it can feel like, okay, we learned a new thing. We're going to put it on the shelf and then we'll move on to the next thing. But fact and theory need each other. They're always intertwined. That just a pile of, you know, what we think of as facts or as data, it doesn't really do anything unless it has a framework in which to interpret it. And that framework is going to change as we learn more, as this dance back and forth between, you know, what we observe and what we think about it. And, you know, the way that I talk about that is through bone.
And one other thing is, as you say in the book, you have one inside you.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's something that I don't know if other people do this. And I really encourage people to do this in the book and whenever I meet them, is just like sit and think for a second about all those parts, all the little motions and things that we normally don't think about. One of my favorite is the interaction of our lower arm bones, that, you know, your ulna, which fits into your humerus, and that gives you that hinge back and forth. There's not a lot of like lateral motion with that. You can move your arms sort of back and forth, but, you know, it's just this, it's sort of like that dog-like motion I mentioned before. It's just kind of forward and back. But our lower arms, what allows us to, you know, shake hands and manipulate things, it's this rollover of the radius over the ulna, and you can sort of – you can feel that if you hold there, even just, if you don't, if you just concentrate on that motion. And when you look at those bones, that it is rounded at the end. You can, you look at it and say, okay, that biomechanically makes sense, that this is something that is rolling over as we – you know, if you put your palm up and then turn it so your palm is down, like that motion that's happening there. I think that's wonderful. Sometimes when I'm just bored at the airport, or I'm out in the field and it's, you know, 1 o'clock and it's 96 degrees or something like that, I just sit and think for a second. Like I haven't been able to fully manage this one yet, but even just thinking about like my own skull, that our skull is not one bone. It's this collection of a whole bunch of bones, and most of it's relatively static, but just being still and thinking like that's what's in there and holding all this wonderful stuff together.
How many bones in the skull?
I think there are about 22 individual bones, but I mean, it varies. That's the thing, that there are some bones called Wormian bones, where sometimes the skull bones don't fuse in the typical pattern, and there'll be these little rounded bones that are left over from our childhood. I think it was particularly present in Incan culture. So sometimes it's called the Inca bone. And that's another example. Sometimes we have bones we don't know about, like you mentioned, like the sesamoid bones, which are bones that grow in tendons. Your patella or your kneecaps are the most famous example of that. It's not attached to your femur. It's held in place by these soft tissues. But there are some other ones, like underneath one of your toes, you might have an extra sesamoid bone that you don't even know about. But for the bones that we do know about, whether our ribs or our limb bones or anything else, I think it's, you know, worthwhile sometimes just almost taking a meditative moment and thinking like it's not only in there, but it's changing, it's growing, it's part of you, and it tells your story. It's the only thing, you know, from our bodies that's likely to last for millions and millions of years. And that's how I tried to end the book, was thinking about, you know, if, you know, when I eventually pass away, if I, you know, got fossilized or buried or something like that, what would a paleontologist of the future, of whatever species they might be, interpret about, you know, who I was, and, you know, kind of turning a lot of these questions back in on myself. So, you know, it's sort of interrogating the human skeleton as I would a dinosaur skeleton, but then thinking about, well, what would somebody else be able to tell about me as a person if all that was left was even, say, just like half of my femur? And they'd be able to say quite a bit, like bones are our own little personal time capsules.
That's it for this episode. Get your science news at our website, www.scientificamerican.com. And don't forget to also visit our friends at the Nature website, www.nature.com, where you can check out the Nature Podcast. The latest one covers the success rate of invasive bird species and how to craft the perfect crepe. And back to SciAm, follow us on Twitter, where you'll get a tweet whenever a new item hits the website. Our Twitter name is @SciAm. For Scientific American Science Talk, I'm Steve Mirsky. Thanks for clicking on us.